Hello, this is Michelle Weston with Wellness Learning Curves 2.0. We're part of Radio 360, talk radio for women. We like to empower women all over the world. So with Wellness Learning Curves 2.0, I like to bring you every week a new interview, a new point of view from some very interesting people about living with a chronic condition and how we can make lifestyle changes to shift our attitude in living with a chronic condition. Or in today's universe, unfortunately, in the 21st century, chronic conditions, plural. And I called one of my favorite people again, who is a licensed social worker here in New York City, because Tammy and I have something in common. Not just that we both are coaches, and that we both went on a journey. She before
me. Magnificent.
And are fabulous. And are fabulous, just like you guys out there. We're fabulous. That we're going to talk about something that both of us have as a chronic condition. And even though we have tackled it and have it under control for her almost 20 years already, and me 16 years coming up, and that is that ugly word, obesity. Now, why obesity is considered a chronic condition? Tammy St. Clair, why is obesity considered a chronic condition?
Because it never goes away. You can be in recovery, but just like with diabetes, people say, oh, I got rid of my diabetes. No, you didn't. You just put it into remission. So you got control of it. Same way with obesity, because if anything in that delicate balance changes, you can go back to being obese. If anything in the delicate balance around maintaining control of your diabetes changes, and so you could go from an A1C of 5.7 and something changes, you get a more stressful situation, you're not dealing with stress very well, you start eating a little bit off, and now all of a sudden your A1C is back to 8. And your diabetes is full-blown again.
So do me a favor, explain to people the ratio of what A1C, which is your blood sugar level, guys. So A1C is a blood A1C sugar level. Yeah, you're going to explain it better than I am. So go.
Your hemoglobin A1C is the marker that measures a three-month picture window of what your blood sugar has been. So your daily sugar numbers that you take from your Dexcom or your continuous glucose monitor, whatever you use, your CGM, or you're pricking your fingers, whatever. Those are your immediate daily numbers that you need to do something about. If your sugar is going low, you can eat to bring it up. If it's going high, you need to take insulin to bring it down, right? Your A1C is the three-month picture. And ideally, non-diabetic is under 6.
Okay.
There's a little controversy. They're playing with numbers right now. Some will tell you it's 6.3. I tend to say six is easy to remember. We're good. So you can do that with diet and exercise and stress management and lifestyle, but we're not always really great with that. And depending on our family history, depending on our body type, depending on a whole lot of things in our genetics, will either help us to keep it low without medication or without, you know, with only oral meds, without insulin injections, without other stuff, or it's just gonna have its way. So it needs our participation. So my grandmother died blind with kidney disease and everything all from diabetes. My dad died with chronic kidney failure from diabetes.
And why does it affect the kidneys and sometimes the liver? Why does it do that?
Because those are the kidneys are in the liver are the filters for our body. And think of if you looked at sugar molecules, like, you know, you're the little grains of sugar that we put into things. If you looked at them under the microscope, they're very sharp and they're, you know, jagged and everything.
Hold on a second. Do me a favor. I'm getting a lot of static. Pull your hair back away from those earphones because it's okay. Almost like, yeah, that's almost what I'm hearing, babe. And okay. I think it'll help because it's okay when you play with the earphones. It's just the hair against it.
Gets it in. Yeah.
Yeah. That's what's going on. Rubber band, maybe.
Yeah. That's what I'm looking for. I usually have a few of them sitting here.
That's what it is. I mean, just FYI, not that you are happy to hear that, but.
Okay. Pause it for 1 second.
Yeah. I will. Let me pause for a sec.
Okay.
Dan, we're restarting.
While diabetes affects everything, so like I was saying, the molecules in the bloodstream, they can be sharp, and your kidney's filtering them out. And so it gets all these microscopic cuts and stuff. Well, then the kidney has to heal itself. And what happens when you heal? You get a scar tissue. So over years of high sugars, that's how kidney damage and the liver damage and everything happens, because they're continually getting cut up on the inside where they're filtering, and the body's constantly healing them. And now it's thick and tough and they stop working. So with obesity,
and let's clarify something. When we say obesity, we know there's this BMI, body mass index. We know all about that, you guys. Some of us hate us. Some of us use it very well. It's still under conjecture.
It's just a marker. It's just a way to get information. If people would look at the BMI table as a way to provide information, as opposed to a goal setting, you know, the BMI table says I should be 145 pounds. Meanwhile, you're 5'9", 5'10". You're never going to be 145 pounds unless you're skeletal.
You don't want to look like you're a skeleton.
Right. Your bone structure is going to weigh more than that. Mm-hmm. So like in the BMI table, so I started my weight loss journey with my lap band in 2005, and I was, the last known weight I was 287 before I had surgery. I know I was over 300 at some point, but let's say 287, and I'm 5'7". So it says that I should be 5'7", 160, 165 pounds. Except that when I get below 175, I look like I'm sick. In fact, one of my surgeons said to me, I was 177, and they said to me, are you okay? Are you having some health issues? Because you're way too thin. Now, I was happy because I was like, oh, I'm in a size 6. And this is what should be happening. And they were like, no. You're way too thin. And so the BMI table is simply, especially if you've been morbidly obese for your entire life, it's simply a data gathering. It's a data point. That's it. Mm-hmm. Just like your weight is a piece of data in one moment of time that just provides the information. That's it. It has nothing to do with your moral compass, has nothing to do with your confidence. It has nothing to do with any of the things. We tend so much emotion that he reflected back at us on the scale. Oh, it went up. That means I'm a bad person. It went down. I must be a great person. No, doesn't mean any of those things. It's just a number. At that moment, I could weigh you again in 25 minutes and you could be 2 pounds higher, 2 pounds lower because you went to the bathroom or you drank, you know, your two big glasses, cups of water.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing, you know, look, I'm now 5'5", you know, we do shrink as we get older, by the way, guys, don't be surprised.
I'm on 5'6" and a half.
Yeah. Well, I used to be 5'7" and now I'm 5'5".
I used to be closer to 5'8". Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm getting shorter too.
Yeah. It's cranky. Well, you know what? It's called gravity, guys. So that's what happens with gravity.
Goes back to us being hangry, right?
Yes. Goes back to us being hangry. I'm hangry about that. But it's also, I also think what's important is, like Tammy is saying, my gastroenterologist, when I go below 150, being 100 and at 5'5", when I go below 150 and being older, being over 50, he's just like, I really don't want you down here because your bones need, you know, bones are more fragile as we get older, blah, blah, blah. And you need to make sure that you keep that strength and that protection and those muscles and all of those things. And I take supplements and I do my thing. I have a vertical sleeve, had a lap band, but we had to change it just for medical reasons, blah, blah, blah. The point is that when I worked in magazines, and you guys hear me say this just because it's a good marker, the average size of a woman in America is 5'5". She's 165 pounds. And she wears a size 14. Now, we know that the world thinks that a 14 is huge. But that has more to do with the designers of clothes who many times are gay. And men,
they only want hangers. They want bodies with no features because they just want a hanger to put their design on.
Yep.
That's it. They want a walking hanger.
Yep. And they want their clothes to work, not to consider that. And that's why I was on the founding team of Mode Magazine, that bodies have curves. I prefer women with curves. I like a little junk in the trunk on a woman. I like some breastises. Listen, I have small up top. And you know what? I learned early in the world of fashion to buy a really good bra and push them up so that they look good under my clothes. And my husband doesn't care. As long as the theory that's been around for a long time is, as long as it fits perfectly in a martini glass,
it's a waste of time.
Or a perfect breast fits in a cocktail glass for, you know, one of those fancy cocktails that we now drink, like a Cosmo. So I'm okay with that. But understand that, you know, curves are good. You know, depends on where you carry it. Yes. Yes. If you're more pear-shaped, you're better off than somebody like my family who carries it more in the middle. So we're called more barrel-shaped.
Or apples.
Barrel or apple. Barrels, normally they say more about guys. But I know who gives a crap about a fruit bowl. But again, just like the BMI, we have markers. So how would you explain to somebody? And I'm weird. So I used to say, I am a toaster on top of a refrigerator when I weighed 289. Right.
I was a bowling ball on top of a beach ball on top of sticks.
See, there you go. So
right?
Understand. And we can laugh about that now. We're not being cruel about our bodies. We've gotten to the point where we actually can smile and go, listen to the silliness that we created. And listen to how far we've come.
And the thing is there is, however, just like with the BMI, which is a provider of information, body shape is also a provider of information. So someone who carries most of their weight around the middle, so we would call that an apple shape.
More heart disease.
Correct. Because that's all brown fat. That's all active fat. So you have more heart disease. You have more high blood pressure. You have more diabetes in those folks. You have more of this active metabolic diseases, because that's active metabolic fat that's causing problems.
Explain brown fat, because people are going, why does it have a color?
Well, because yellow or white fat is inactive. That's mostly the people that you see that are very bottom heavy, right? That they're very pear-shaped. That's
they have mostly more thigh, that, more ass.
Right. And that's mostly that yellow, inactive fat. It's also the hardest to lose. You're not going to really, when you lose weight, you're not going to really change your shape very much.
Interesting. Yeah, I didn't think about that. That's true.
Yellow fat.
Okay.
Versus the brown fat, when you lose weight, your shape's going to change a lot, because that fat right now, it's all encompassing the organs. So the organs have very little space to move and to do what they're supposed to do, because they're getting crowded out. Think of it as you're in a very tight closet, right? And you're trying to move around in a tight closet. And if you're trying to do your job in a very tight closet, you can't do it very well.
Yeah.
So the organs get smushed in there. But once you lose weight and that opens up, now I can do my job and I've got a little more room to move and be more efficient in the things that I can take care of in there.
Yeah. And so I just want, right. And I just wanted people to understand, because we talk about this and, you know, you listen to doctors and your brain just starts to go blah, 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 blah. Like that teacher in Peanuts. I always think of that. Right. But what's important about this is, and Tammy and I, as we learned and got our master's in health and wellness coaching, what's important about nutrition and about metabolism, about all of those things, carbohydrates, blah, 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 is that's why I asked her to explain brown fat versus yellow and white fat, inactive fat versus active fat. I come, like her family, from more in the middle of our bodies with skinny arms and legs. That's great for short skirts and for, you know, sleeveless things. But when
really sucks for your health.
Yeah, it really sucks for your health. But when I decided to go to bariatric surgery, which again, for the 9 millionth time, I'm going to say should be the last frontier. You know, if we can do it with diet and exercise, that's great. But not all of us can do that. We can't. We have broken switches in our heads. Yes, it's been studied. Yes, there's lots in journals. I'm not making this up. Look in the DSM-5.
That's why all of this GLP-1 stuff is happening and working, because...
Explain GLP-1.
The GLP-1s are medications that trigger these.
Oh, are we talking about Ozempic and metformin and A1C,
Ozempic,
Wegovy. What's the one with an M?
Mounjaro.
Rybelsus.
Right. All of these work on this GLP-1, and it's something lipase. Well, I don't remember the whole long name of it, and it's not important. All you're going to ever hear is GLP-1. What that does, though, is that that's part of the trigger system. And when our system is working properly and that enzyme is working properly, it's triggering to our brain, hey, I'm full, I'm good, we're good. When it's not working properly, when that switch is not working, no matter how many times you bang it to come on, it's not coming on. So all of a sudden, the entire buffet at the all-you-can-eat restaurant is
calling your name
onto your plate and down your throat. And you don't have this sensation of being full until you're overly full.
And for me, what that sounds like to me is, and I had the privilege to work with Dr. Roney and his team over at Weill Cornell, a New York Presbyterian, and he did a lot of work on endocrinology, which is about that, and diabetes and so forth. There's a broken switch in some of our brains. Seriously.
Yep.
Seriously.
And those are the enzymes that control it.
Yep, that's leptin and ghrelin. Those are two that can switch on and off. And even what bariatrics can help with is to shut that off so that there's a clearer sense of being able to do that. It can go back on, right, Tammy? The switch mm-hmm. can be flipped again. Some of us, that's why we're struggling now with having to turn, because many of us who go to bariatrics now have diabetes 1 or are going towards that. We're making our doctors nervous about our levels. We're making them nervous about our hearts and cholesterol levels. And they're like, you got to do something because I don't want your health and wellness to be so affected that your lifestyle becomes something that isn't as long as it should be. Your life should be long. You should have a long life, but you want a life where you're healthy. So obesity is not your friend. And the reason why brown fat versus yellow and white fat isn't good is because it becomes more dangerous because it's in the middle. For Tammy and I, we know our family history. We've looked at it. We don't shut our eyes to it. Thankfully, we both believe in healthcare. We also believe in integrative care. That's where nutritionists step in and working with yoga therapists and working with PT and choosing a physical activity you love, choosing how to handle your stress, finding ways to be more mindful. Okay. And that is a big part of what happens with obesity. We get into this place where we stop being mindful. We just sort of forget that we need to pay attention a little
more.
Well,
I don't know that it's so much forgetting as it is feeling hopeless.
Oh, I just forget. See, I just sometimes forget.
Mental health comes in is when we get to a point, we figure, whether consciously or unconsciously, what's the point?
Yeah. Okay.
I've done everything that I can do and it's still not going anywhere. So what's the point?
Yeah.
And so it becomes this perpetuation of this hopeless situation.
Okay.
Because we never feel like we can get a handle on it. And society makes us feel like it is somehow my own moral failing that my
weight isn't an issue. But our heads do that. They say, I'm just failing.
Society tells us that. The commercials we see on TV tells us that. The conversations that we hear when people say, oh, look at that fat person over there. They must eat like a whole, you know, hopefully McDonald's still has food when they leave, you know. And so there's a lot of judgment, a lot of shaming, a lot of all of that stuff that goes on. And as an obese person, it's about learning that this is not about who you are as a person. It's about how your body is processing things. Now, do you have a responsibility to learn and do everything that you can to make a difference? Yes, we do. We have a responsibility. It doesn't do us any good when we just throw up our hands and go, oh, doesn't matter anyway. So let me just go have what I'm going to have. I'm just going to go eat my feelings away, go do whatever. That's not helpful, right? Because you're giving away your power.
Yeah.
You have to hold on to your power and exercise your power that says, I'm going to do everything that I can in order to provide my body the best nutrition possible. And if I lose weight, great. If I don't, that's okay too, because I know I'm giving my body all the nutrients that it needs.
And making better choices. And Tammy and I are not saying, again, the millionth time I've said this, but I'm going to say it again because some of you forget, just like we do. That doesn't mean you're not going to have pizza again or a piece of birthday cake. It means that you're going to have less, enjoy it, and not punish yourself that now that you ate that, all sheets to the wind, right?
Right. That's like, you know, if you're in New York and you have one New York slice of pizza.
Yeah, the best. Sorry.
Right? So that's one slice. And if anybody has never been to New York and does not know what a New York slice is, it's basically like an 18-inch pie or 20 inches or even bigger. I don't know how big they are, but cut into like six pieces.
So well, 18 like is more like 10 slices. But yeah. And they're about 300-400 like, calories, really, just a slice of cheese pizza.
And they're not like, you know, out in the Midwest when you go to some of the big name places and you get these pies that you think. I remember when I first came to New York, the first night I was here, I was a nanny and the family said, oh, we're ordering pizza. How many slices do you want? And I was thinking, I grew up in the Midwest, so slices are small. I was like, I don't know, 3, 4. And they looked at me like, oh my God.
Because they're said, bigger.
You know what?
Because bigger is better.
One slice and we'll see how you do. And when the slices came, it was as big as my head. I'm like, oh yeah, no, one slice is fine. You know? Versus as big as my hand. You know, three slices as big as your hand is very different than one slice as big as your head. And so, and it's learning that nothing is off limits unless you have some other chronic condition.
Sure.
Like diabetes or hypertension, something like that. That really,
or even rheumatoid arthritis. There's certain things. Rheumatoid arthritis, less garlic. They have a problem with garlic. There's things that when you have other chronic conditions, you do have to think about it. But we're talking about, you know what? What we do, Tammy and I do, is we order pizza with vegetables instead of sausage and ham and pepperoni, because we know that the fat in those three meats are not great for us. But vegetables are terrific.
It's a great way to get in veggies.
Right, but, exactly.
You know, it's everyone thinks, oh, you have weight loss surgery and
it's all fixed.
The common refrain from every person going into surgery, I can tell you as a therapist, as someone who sees patients and clients before they go in for surgery, and once they come out is, oh, I'm never going to eat this thing again.
Yeah,
this
really?
Is the thing that got me into trouble. Mashed potatoes, pizza, pasta, rice, desserts, cookies, cakes,
overstuffed chips. Sandwiches.
Those are all the things that got me to this point of being 300 or 400 pounds, and I'm never going to eat those again. And I'm like, and I'm going to call you a liar because I know that at some point you are going to have a slice of pizza. You are going to have a slice of cake. You are going to have
a scoop of ice cream,
sandwich, a scoop of ice cream. You are going to have some of these things, but you're not going to have them the way you used to have them.
Yep.
Right? Now, if I can get in a half a slice of pizza, I'm doing good.
Yeah.
When it's the size of my
and
face.
That's looking at portions. And, you know, that when you have a chronic condition like obesity, it's learning and relearning tools and strategies that help us, whether you've had bariatric surgery or whether you're using a new food plan that helps you get to a place that you feel more comfortable and your health is better. You're just looking for strategies on how you're going to look at this, right, Tammy? I mean, you're looking for tools. You're looking for ways to go, how can I help myself? You talked about emotions. Are you aware of your emotions? Are you eating your emotions? Are you suppressing feelings of anxiety or depression with food? Because when you stop and you take the time to figure out, how did I get here? And what is this chronic condition doing for to me and how can I help myself manage this? Because people manage a lot of things. People, you know, look, people have lots of different things. People manage their cholesterol, they manage their stress. And it's worth doing that because you want your life to be as long and as full as possible, right, Tammy? I mean, that's what this is about. But we wanted to talk about chronic conditions and talk about obesity because it's such it's a hard word.
It's a hard word because there are so many judgments tied to it.
Thank you.
Right? So many people see an obese person walking down the street and they immediately begin making judgments, whether they're conscious of those judgments or not. And even someone who's lost weight, I can even find myself making judgments. And I know what it's like to be that person.
Me too. Listen, we're human. We do this.
Right? I know what it's like to be that person who's struggling to walk a little faster on the sidewalk and backing up everybody behind them because you take up so much space and you're going so slow. I know what it's like to be that person who is struggling to get up the stairs on the subway. And
it's harder and you're slower.
It's because you're slower and you're moving more weight and all of that. And I can still find myself going, come on. You know, and being judgmental. It's part of the human condition. Judgmentalness is part of the human condition, right? So we all have to work on
kindness,
our judgments, and our mindset around things because compassion is where we're going to see the most benefit, right? When we show people compassion, when someone shows us compassion, that's when the biggest changes happen. So it doesn't do you any good to sit there or walk behind that person and mumble and grumble and make snarky comments to yourself or to your friends or to your family, whoever you're with, because all that's really doing is showing who you are as a person.
And also
it's not helping that person who needs assistance in front of you.
And also I'm going to say, we need to be more kind with each other and more patient. We don't know everyone's story. Okay. We don't. You don't know their story. You don't know what this is about. You don't know what conditions they have. You don't know what their history, family, medical history is. So take a pause before you decide in your head you're going to make a snarky comment because you may not know what their struggle is. And no, Tammy and I aren't talking about 600-pound people that you see on the reality TV shows. We're talking about how we are on the streets, in the suburbs, in rural situations with people who may be a little bigger than us. Just stop for a minute and think to yourself, how would I feel if somebody was thinking that and then vocalized something that would be hurtful? And it hurts because words hurt, correct, Tammy?
Right. And it can be devastating, which then does nothing but drives that person into whatever their coping mechanism is. And it's probably focused around food. It could be drinking. It could be, drugs. It could be alcohol. It could be any of these things. All of these things that we quote unquote see as vices, right? Gambling, things like that. They're all misappropriated coping mechanisms.
Yep.
And so I can lose myself in the chocolate cake. I can lose myself in playing poker or blackjack or whatever my gambling addiction happens to be around. I can lose myself in a bottle of whiskey or
smoking cigarettes.
I can lose myself. I can take those mental breaks in, you know, having that cigarette, having that, you know, bit of drugs, doing whatever. They're all maladaptive coping skills. And so when you're trying to change this chronic condition of obesity, it's not just eat less and exercise more. Because eating goes with a coping skill.
Yes.
Right?
And a tool or a strategy that you can choose to develop. And it takes time to develop things, right?
Hold that thought, though. We've learned from the moment we've been born, whether that's we come out C-section or we come out the regular way, right? What happens to us? Somebody slaps us on the rear end. We let out this big old wail. They're like, good, there's air in the lungs. Good, we got that. And then what do? They put us on a boob. They give us a nipple. And so what happens? We learn from that instant that food and this motion of chewing and sucking. And if you could see me, I know it's radio, but if you could see me, just imagine making that sucking motion with your mouth and swallowing. Right? We've learned from the moment we breathed air that a way to calm ourselves down is to shove something in our mouth.
Think about that, guys. So you thought maybe it just came from food? No, it started a little earlier, like right out of the gate.
Right out of the gate. And so if we have parents who have no disordered eating themselves, right? They like all kinds of vegetables. They don't have an issue with over-serving, with portion control. There are zero. Let me repeat that. Zero people like that. Everyone has some sort of eating preference, you know, quirk, if you want to call it. And we pass those down to our children, right? My mother hates peas.
Wow.
Guess what? I hate peas. I will eat them in certain situations. If they're mixed into certain things like tuna noodle casserole, that peas go in that, you know, or peas go with certain
things. How about snap peas? You don't like snap peas?
No. Why would I want to eat the skin that they all come in?
Oh, but it's crunchy. It's so crunchy.
Right? So we pass those things on to our children, to our nieces and nephews, whoever we take care of, we pass those on. So now you have a newborn that's had a nipple shoved into their mouth, whether it comes from a bottle or from a boob, that then whenever I get upset, the comforting comes with something in our mouth. And now we wonder why at age, even like a 6 or 7 or 8 year old, when they get upset, they want to have a donut or they want a cookie.
A piece of candy.
Now, a piece of candy, right? They fall off their bike. We as the parent, what do? Oh, here, have a cookie. You'll feel better. The best story I ever heard, I was in Weight Watchers. I was in one of those organized.
No, you're in Weight Watchers. We can say it. It's still my favorite. If we're going to talk about a favorite, Weight Watchers still is one of the best programs. And I'm going to tout it because it works.
Right. But one of the leaders said, you're not going to believe what my granddaughter did the other day. And we're all like, yeah, okay. She said, she fell. She came in the house and was crying. Grandma, I'm hurting. And I said, here, have a cookie. And she looked at the cookie and she kind of looked at me and shrugged and put the cookie on her knee where it was hurting because I told her it would make it feel better. And she didn't get it. And we all cracked up because we do that. We unconsciously associate food with feeling better.
Yeah.
And when you have a child that is not being taught that, right? Because this Weight Watchers leader, her daughter was not teaching, would not do that with her child, would say, it's okay, cry it out, you're going to be fine, But she never offered food as the comfort. And she was like, so I always remember that when I want to have something to eat because something happened, I fell, someone said something nasty. I always remember the cookie is not going to make it feel better. The cookie is actually going to make it feel worse. And my work with my clients is also around the same kinds of principles. is what you're doing truly going to make it feel better? Now, if I can get you to stop and pause and think about that, usually you'll be like, well, no, it's not going to change the fact that I'm anxious that my loved one is in the hospital or that my loved one is sick or I just got this other diagnosis or I just lost my job. But what is it doing? It's giving me a way to not think about
or feel
those things
in a weird way
or feel the emotions that go with thinking about those things. So what I work with them on is beginning to be mindful and acknowledging this is pretty scary. I just got a diagnosis that I don't know what to do with. This is pretty scary and I'm scared. I'm anxious. I just lost my job. I don't know what I'm going to do. Having food is not going to change any of that. And it's only going to make you not think about it for the 5 seconds, 5 minutes, 10 minutes that you're eating that food. But then you go back to, oh, now I have the original problem. And now I've gone off whatever eating program that I'm on, trying to get myself healthy, trying to remain healthy, trying to develop new coping skills, trying to do all of these things. And now I have two hammers to hit myself over the head with, because why am I being so stupid to you know, eat like this? And then we add in there, and I just slid it in on you on purpose, all of the negative self-talk. Oh, I'm such an idiot, right? All of these things get balled up like a big old ball of yarn, and you start pulling on one and all of this stuff starts coming out.
Yeah.
And there are people that are listening that are like, oh yeah, I know that. Oh yeah, I can understand that. And so all of these coping skills, when we go to lose weight, whether we're losing weight through a program, we're losing weight with surgery, we're losing weight no matter how, we have to learn better ways of managing the emotions and the feelings, right?
Yeah.
The physiological feelings that
exactly.
come with, right?
Exactly.
Whenever have you felt anger that you didn't flush or you didn't get this burst of nearly uncontrollable energy when you were truly angry? Not just annoyed. Because we can all get annoyed and we get a little hot under the collar, you know, everything goes a little bit. But when we're livid, right? That's why we have in the court system those things about it was a crime of passion because it's uncontrollable, right? So we all have to learn how to manage. Anger comes with energy. And if I don't know how to manage that energy, I'm going to eat because I know that that will help calm that energy down. It will help. And if I'm really not thinking about it because of my training in emotion stability, I'm going to eat things with a lot of sugar in because sugar is a depressant, right? Or I'm going to eat things with a lot of starch and flour in.
Salt. Potato chips.
Very carbohydrate heavy. Well, salt and potato chips are a way of getting out the energy, right? Those are crunchy. They're foods that express the anger. But if I'm trying to just avoid the anger or get it to nullify it, right? Not feel it, not okay. get it out, just nullify okay. it, make it disappear.
Right.
That's when you have the things that are carb and sugar heavy.
Okay.
Because those are the things that in our brain are depressants and make us go to sleep. How many, everybody, if you're driving, whatever, don't raise your hand, but think about Thanksgiving dinner. You eat this beautiful Thanksgiving dinner. And then what do? You go to the living room, plop down in the chair, in the recliner, on the couch, go to sleep.
Or watch football. If it's Thanksgiving.
Well, watching football from behind my eyeballs, right? I'm watching football from behind my eyelids. And somebody walks by and you go, you're not watching football. You're sleeping. No, I'm not. I'm watching. Meanwhile, it's like, yeah.
You're in a coma.
Right.
I call it a food coma.
Right. And so that's kind of where we all try to get to when we don't know how to manage those emotions in the moment. And that's kind of where when we can begin to manage those types of things also allows us to get our eating under control, also allows us to think ahead. How am I going to deal with this when this situation happens? And have everything sort of begin to come together around this chronic condition called obesity, because it's not just about eat less and exercise more. Just from what we've talked about today, you can see that it's this entire wagon wheel of things that feed into our weight, right? Yeah. If us and our weight are at the middle of the wagon wheel, it's all of these other spokes that feed into it that we have to figure out how to manage well. And sometimes we go into surgery and we think, oh, this is going to be it, like I said earlier. But that's only dealing with one of those spokes of the wagon wheel.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. That wagon wheel, if you were around in the 1800s, you knew that you could still go a little ways, minus one. It's when you got to minus four or five that your wagon would truly be breaking down.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of what we want to do, is we want to pull out those spokes so that we can get a better handle on the mental and emotional side of this chronic condition while you are dealing with your doctors around the physiological side of this chronic condition.
Yeah.
Because it's both sided. It's two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. I wanted to also share, Tammy, that was so great. I really appreciate you. You know, you're a plethora of knowledge, and I love you as a friend and as an expert and as a peer. And that's why you guys will hear her a number of times, because the two of us have conversations and light bulbs go off and I say, we need to talk about this, or vice versa, right? We do.
The next show just got an idea for the next show that we're going to do.
Yep. And
you know, it's going to happen.
Right. And Tammy also leads a support group here in New York to help people with who have had bariatric surgery support each other and understand we all need support. That's why I'm doing
not an island unto ourselves. No matter how much you think you are.
You got it. And with a chronic condition, we need more support. And even if you've had your surgery, you've lost your weight, if you can have a group of people who know what this is like, it is a gift. If the hospital, if the program that you're with offers that for free, you know, the ones that we do.
Even if not for free, if it's a reasonable cost and you can afford it.
Yes, you know, absolutely.
I would say take advantage of it, because we need.
We also need mirrors to be able to hear ourselves through somebody else and go, oh, right. I struggle with that. How did you handle that? Well, I do this. Oh, well, what about this? So you can bounce things off of others with chronic conditions like obesity and help each other. Because we don't live by ourselves.
Can call you out on something, right?
Yes, so you're absolutely.
Oh, blah, 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 blah. And that person goes, oh, well, you know, I dealt with that and that's this. And you're like, oh, that's not me. And then you start to think and you're like, oh, gee.
Maybe it is.
Hiding your face? Well, maybe it is, right? Exactly. But if you don't have peers, you don't have a support system there with people who feel that they can, you know, talk back to you, then you are going it alone. And I don't know about you, but every single journey that you take completely and totally solely alone by yourself is a whole lot harder than the ones you take with other people.
Yeah.
And there are plenty of journeys in our life that are solo journeys.
Yes.
Only we can manage. Chronic conditions around weight are not those. You do not have to take this journey alone.
No. And you know what? It's great to be able to have others for ideas, for support, for compassion. You know, we need to be more compassionate with each other. It's so important. We forget that.
And with ourselves.
Oh, definitely with ourselves. The last thing I want to just mention for people to think about, which we've talked about, but there's a woman named Susan Albers. She's a psychologist, and I adore her. Tammy likes her, too. We have our favorites. She's definitely an advocate for learning mindfulness and techniques and strategies. But being a psychologist, one of the things that she talks about in a new book that she has called Eat.Cue. Is what happens when the words don't come when we are going through that struggle with food, when we are not knowing how to explain to ourselves or to explore what's going on in our heads? She talks about that we all struggle at times to verbalize our feelings. We do.
Mm-hmm.
And emotions are complex and they're confusing. So they don't just like pop into your mind, and they're not perfect. You don't have like a moment of clarity where everything comes that way. What you can think about, though, is that if we learn to challenge ourselves to identify and express our feelings, my goodness, that's when you have a chance to resolve those moments where you have an eating issue, where you're just like, oh, I just had a horrible day. I need some chocolate, like more chocolate than usual. Not just a piece of like chocolate, but like a chocolate pint of chocolate.
I need to take a bath in chocolate.
Yeah. But
I need to bathe in it it's been such a bad day.
Right. But fortunately, we can learn. And if you find it difficult to verbalize how you feel, you can learn. You can find a therapist. You can find a group, a support group. You can find psychologists. There's lots of people out there who really can help you make this, instead of like being this silent conversation that you stew in about a problem, you can approach it differently. You can learn to say, you know what, it's your husband, honey, I need to talk to you right now. If it's a friend, listen, I really need to talk to you about this thing that's been going on. And there's a good reason to learn how to do that, because if you have healthy relationships with others and with food, you're able to identify how you feel and why. And then you can make healthier ways to respond. So remember, when you have questions, whether it's difficult for you to describe, remember, sometimes it comes up that you're sitting there and you go, how do I process what I'm feeling right now in this situation or an event? And how do I, you know, look at when I shut down, when I have this really strong emotion, and then I just stop talking, I just shut down. How about when you try to describe how you feel and you sometimes choose the wrong word? Like, here's a good example. I feel stressed. Do you feel stressed or are you frustrated? So when we learn what words can help us describe where we are and how we feel, we give ourselves the freedom to have a bigger dictionary to go to be able to use, especially with eating, especially with the emotions of why we turn to eating. And that's the reason why Tammy and I will continue this conversation. And as I said, I love spending an hour with her, and we will revisit it. If you have any ideas, right? Tammy, what's your website if they want to go visit you and connect with you? Because I know that, you know, you're connectable on Zoom and you do your thing. What is your website?
It is chooseyoursuccess.com.
See? Chooseyoursuccess.com. And if you have any ideas that you want to share with me and thoughts and things you'd like us to explore regarding living with chronic conditions and how to create more lifestyle changes and strategies and tools and whatnot, I'm at mjwellnessnavigator.com. We both have a place where you can go to info at and contact us directly. Both of us have an opportunity to talk to you and do an introduction for 15, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, depends on what our schedules look like. Take advantage of that. Find someone to connect to. And I wish you a great day, a great week. Enjoy the sunshine. And know you're not in this alone. Chronic conditions are experienced by many. And we can create lifestyle changes to make sure that the quality of our lives is the best it can be. So thank you for listening. And we'll see you next week. Thanks, Tammy. Really appreciate this conversation. See you later.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hi, it's Michelle Weston again with some tips and tricks and ideas for you. I wanted to share some links and some books that help with healing, including some steps and guidelines. And I've spoken before about Louise DeSalvo's book, Writing as a Way of Healing, that she wrote in 2000. I use this book as a base for my Writing to Heal courses when I work with groups. And you can learn more about the concept and practice of narrative medicine through Rita Sharon's book. It's called Honoring the Stories of Illness, written in 2006. Or look at Annie Brewster and Rachel Zimmerman's book titled The Healing Power of Storytelling, which came out in 2022. If you're looking for a more how-to manual that might take you deeper into some of the ideas explored, check out Lori Edwards' book, Life Disrupted, Getting Real About Chronic Illness in Your 20s and 30s, that was written in 2008. And the nice thing about this guidebook is that it's broken down by sections and chapters, so you can pick and choose the topics that are of interest to you. Through the book, it is geared towards patients in their 20s and 30s, so many of the lessons are applicable to more broader audience, but definitely 20s and 30s if you've just gotten a diagnosis of a chronic illness. The other thing is, if you'd like a more topic-based read that have more illness lessons applicable to a wider audience, check out Sulika Jaoud's past New York Times Life Interrupted blogs. And that was her experiences with having cancer, which are really, really amazing. So look them up. If research is more your thing, you may want to check out Lori Edwards' book, In the Kingdom of the Sick, A Social History of Chronic Illness in America, written in 2013, or Stephen Phillips and Dana Parrish's book, most recently that came out in 2020, which is called Chronic, The Hidden Cause of the Autoimmune Pandemic and How to Get Healthy Again. We work hard to help people, those of us in the healthcare business, whether it's integrative, whether it's more from a medical skew. We want you to be well. And so tune in to Wellness Learning Curves 2.0 with me, Michelle Weston, your host, or shoot me some ideas on things that you'd like to learn that you feel that we haven't covered yet at mjwellnessnavigator.com. That's my website. Wishing you a wonderful day, and we'll see you again on the radio.